I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Okay, so welcome to the Explaining History podcast for this week. And this week I'm going to be looking at the Russian aristocracy from about 1890 through to 1917, and maybe slightly beyond. The first thing to talk about, really, is that with the Russian aristocracy, actually perhaps less is written about them than about any other class within the Russian Revolution. Possibly this is because, you know, the victors have written history. Possibly this is because the fate of the aristocracy, which is the most bloody and catastrophic and tragic following 1917, has been less of an area of scholastic interest in general. Before we go any further, I think that one of the things that needs to be said about the Russian aristocracy in the run-up to 1917 is a distinction. The aristocracy and the nobility are two separate entities. The aristocracy really are the top 100 to 200 noble families in Russia. People who are very well known to the Tsar, extraordinarily rich, unfathomably rich, perhaps some of the wealthiest aristocrats in Europe, enormous landowners, very important parts of the Tsar's administration, and very important parts of the military as well. Very influential politically, religiously, culturally, socially, you name it. Then below them, there's a whole tranche of the nobles, if you will, who are more minor titled people, very often not having very much money at all. There's a whole swathe of minor aristocrats or noblemen who are, by the dawn of the 20th century, really financially struggling. And it is among these people that the Tsar quite frequently finds that he has nobles who oppose him. So we've got to imagine this may be 1, perhaps 5% of super, super wealthy members of the aristocracy, and then a vast, vast number are, you know, numbering into 1 or 2 million, really, of relatively, you know, ranging from relatively well-to-do to actually dirt-poor nobility. The nobles, contrary to what many Soviet histories would tell you, the nobles actually had, before the revolution, an important part to play within Russian society. And it is because the Tsar and the autocracy stifle the abilities of the Russian nobility to do what it is they felt they should be doing, that you actually create, that you actually see a more violent revolutionary situation developing. If we cast our minds all the way back to the 19th century, there had been instances of revolutionary activity from the nobility. The Tsar Nicholas I was very conscious that when Napoleon invaded Russia, that it was the nobles who really led the armies of Russia to defeat him. They don't just chase him out of Russia, but march all the way to France. And when these men get to France, they see how modern France is and how well European, French and other Europeans live, and begin to question really whether it is Tsarism is capable of providing those kinds of things for Russia. If we skip forward from to the 1820s, the first great uprising within Russia in the 19th century in 1826 is by the Decembrists, who are noblemen and officers, many of whom have fought in the Napoleonic Wars and have fought to establish, have risen up against the Tsar to establish constitutional government, i.e. limitations on the Tsar's power and modern forms of government that will hopefully draw Russia out of its backward peasant past. Moving forward again, by 1861, when Alexander II brings about his emancipation of the peasantry, once more you have key members of the nobility who are hoping for more and who are looking for more modernisation and change. Between 1861 and 1881, gradually, it's those reforms and that reforming zeal from Alexander II that starts to veer off and starts to falter and to fail and to retrench itself back into more reactionary and conservative ways of thinking, as all of a sudden ministers around Alexander II start to realise that the modernisation brings with it all manner of unfortunate threats to autocracy. So by the 1860s, 1870s, many noblemen realise ultimately that the Russia that they would like to see developing perhaps isn't going to. And they notice that the Tsar is storing up a huge powder keg of resentment. As I've said in my previous podcast about the peasantry, the reforms of Alexander II were botched and the emancipation was botched, and that left actually the peasantry in a worse situation than it had been before the emancipation. The nobles live out in the countryside for the most part. They are remote and live amongst a sea of increasingly angry and embittered and resentful and volatile peasantry. Throughout the 1890s, there's increasing unrest on the land, and then there's an explosion of anger and violence in 1905. So it was within the interests of the peasant, of the nobility, to facilitate change. They knew all too well that Russia was a powder keg. The Tsar and the nobles around him were able to insulate themselves from these realities and able to ignore them. The nobles are less able to do that, and they are less able to ignore the harsh realities close to them. The nobles were equally aware that amongst the middle classes, there was the very small middle class in Russia, there's a great deal of discontent, because once again, the nobles were monopolizing the good, nice and well-paid jobs within the Tsarist administration, you know, jobs in the civil service, in the army, and in other key areas. This isn't to say that the nobles were completely useless in these jobs, far from it. One of the things that the nobles were very, very useful for was creating the structure of Russian local government, or the zemstvo. The zemstvo were a very handy way of getting things done, such as creating schools and hospitals and rural clinics and building roads and bridges and aqueducts and aquifers and wells and all those sorts of handy things at a local level. The kinds of things that the Tsar's government was very, very poor in doing. So by the 1890s, the big nobles, the big aristocrats that we talked about earlier on, they had been given license by Nicholas II really to rule within the regions, within rural Russia, like feudal lords. They could rule like little dictators. And they frequently overruled the lower nobles, who were the ones who were doing the useful work with the zemstvo. And when this happened, you suddenly get the sense amongst the lower nobles.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Nobles, that they really are the people working for Russia. They really are the patriots, and they really are the people who are doing useful stuff. And this sets them against the aristocracy and against the Tsar. So, interestingly enough, by the time of about the 1905 revolution, you actually have a huge swathe of the nobility in rural Russia who are opposed to the Tsar. After the Tsar's just about managed to retain control following 1905, the nobles encounter, there's an increasing sense of gloom from 1905 to 1917 that really Russia is doomed. They've had a very big taste of revolution in 1905. Many nobles are chased off the land, their farmhouses burnt down, their manor houses, burnt down, and their land seized by the peasants. And it's a devil of a job for them to get that land back, and it takes quite a lot of armed force. We go through this era of gloom, where the nobles look to the Tsar and they realise that the Tsar will never do the sensible things that are necessary in order to bring Russia forward into the 20th century. And some of the nobles wonder whether adopting Western ways and Western European modern politics and economics will be the thing to do in Russia, or whether that there is a more Russian answer. An answer really hidden more in Russia's own past, a more well thought out version of the way the Tsar thought about things. And this era of gloom really is deeply compounded by World War One. When World War One breaks out in the summer of 1914, the instinct of many of the nobility is to go and to declare themselves loyal to Mother Russia. The nobles perform many useful services at this time. They are some of the most capable officers in the army, though actually some of them treat the peasants, the Russian peasant soldiers, with immense cruelty. Many of the nobles who establish all the things that a modern army needs that the Tsar can't provide. They go to the front and set up, with the Zemstvo, they go to the front and they dig trenches for the men. The aristocratic generals aren't aware that trenches are necessary in modern warfare with artillery. They assume that the peasants will just simply lie on the ground. They go to the front line and they build field hospitals and field clearing stations. They set up tents and temporary barracks. They raise money so that the troops can be bought things like proper boots and greatcoats and other equipment. They set up canteens for the men to feed them properly. So all these nobles and members of noble society are doing the kinds of things that really the Tsar should be doing himself. So they're filling a gap within Russians, and had been doing this for many years. They've been filling a gap during the war that the Tsar should have been filling, and also during times of catastrophe and famine back home in Russia, such as the 1892 Volga famine. It is the nobility and the Zemstvo that are running around and really organising the relief for these catastrophes. So quite rightly, by the time 1917 happens, by the time the February Revolution happens, it is the nobility that look upon themselves as being the people to lead Russia. It's no coincidence that Prince Lvov, formerly head of Zemgor, which is the nationwide Zemstvo body, winds up as the first prime minister of the new provisional government. And again, this ignites certain class tensions within Petrograd in 1917. The first protest of the Petrograd Soviet outside the Tauride Palace is one where placards saying, you know, we have lost a Tsar but gained a prince, who voted for these people, is writ large. The great catastrophe for the nobility is the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. Lenin, Trotsky, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Bukharin, and all the other key Bolshevik revolutionaries are agreed on one thing, that there must be a terrific revolutionary bloodletting in order to move Russia forward to the kind, to the planned socialist society that is envisaged. A revolutionary terror must inevitably be a part of this. I'll talk about the Red Terror in a separate podcast, but suffice to say that when the Russian Civil War begins, this is the opportunity that Lenin and the Cheka have been waiting for in order to bring about this radical readjustment of society. War provides a great cloud, if you will, in which to carry out a wholesale slaughter of the Russian aristocracy. There have been few instances in the 20th century where a class-based mass killing has been as comprehensive and as far-reaching as that which happens to the Russian aristocracy. The only problem for the Bolsheviks is that their plans for a new classless society are severely hampered by the fact that many of the nobles and the aristocrats are not just landowners, but technicians, scientists, artists, thinkers, writers, engineers, designers, and social planners and all the rest of it. The people that know how to do things, and they know how to do the kinds of things that are going to make this new society work, they're not workers, they're not peasants, they are the nobility. And so it becomes, it's not an option initially to kill them all off. When, after the Civil War has ended, Lenin realises that the country lies in ruins, he has to make a series of unpalatable choices. In fact, even during the Civil War, Trotsky had to rely on former nobles and former Tsarist officers to make up the bulk of the officer corps of the new Red Army. And with these two decisions meant that between 1917 and 1924, when Lenin dies, that an element of the old nobility managed to survive. After 1924, up until 1941, Stalin dealt with the remainders of the aristocracy through his various purges and terrors. And he was very quick to point out that these people still existed. And so when things went wrong in Russia, particularly during Stalin's five-year plans and his forced industrialization of Russia, he could point back to the existence of these class enemies and whip up all manner of quite bloodthirsty class resentment and hatred amongst the new working classes and use that to power his various purges and terrors. Okay, well, thanks for listening today. And obviously, if you have any questions, you can email me at www.explaininghistory.com. Sign up for our newsletter there. And if you want to tune in next time, I'll be looking at the growth of the middle classes prior to the revolution, and then we'll be moving on to look at the various crises from the 1880s all the way through to 1917. Thanks very much, and look forward to podcasting again to you soon. Thank you.